Picture the desert before dawn. Benghazi, Libya, August 1, 1943. 177 B-24 Liberators sitting on the hard pan in the dark, engines turning over one by one, while the sky out over the Mediterranean was still black. The crews climbed aboard quietly. They had been briefed on this target three times. They had studied the scale models, memorized the approach corridors, and traced the route on maps that showed a long haul north across the Mediterranean, up through the Balkans, and into Romania. They knew what was waiting for them. I'm Taildragger. You're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today we need to talk about Ploesti. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, before we get into the mission itself, we have to spend a few minutes on the airplane, because the B-24 Liberator doesn't get its due. It flies in the shadow of the B-17 Flying Fortress in the popular imagination, and that's always bothered me a little. The Liberator was in several respects the superior aircraft. It carried more bombs. It had more range, thanks to a high aspect ratio wing developed by aerodynamicist David Davis, a design that was extraordinarily efficient at cruise altitude. The B-24 was faster than the Fortress and could reach targets that the B-17 couldn't touch, but that Davis wing had a personality. At altitude, it was a thoroughbred. At low speed, at low altitude, it became a different animal entirely. It didn't like being slow, it didn't like being down in the weeds. The wing that gave it range at 25,000 feet had an unforgiving stall characteristic when you pushed it into terrain-following territory. Crews called the airplane the Flying Coffin and the Liberator, though they didn't always say it affectionately, and tidal wave was going to take it down to 200 feet over one of the most heavily defended targets in occupied Europe. The objective was the Ploesti Oil Complex, a cluster of refineries spread across the Wallachian Plain north of Bucharest. In 1943, Ploesti was producing somewhere between a quarter and a third of all the refined petroleum products the Axis powers were burning, depending on whose estimate you use. Aviation fuel, diesel, lubricants. The machinery of war ran on what came out of those refineries. Take out Ploesti, the planners told the general staff, and you shorten the war by 6 months. Those were the words they used. 6 months. High-altitude precision bombing had been tried before. A small raid in June of 1942, a handful of B-24s flying out of Egypt, had accomplished almost nothing. The smoke, the industrial haze, the altitude, and the inevitable scatter of bombs released from 20,000 feet made accuracy nearly impossible against a target spread across miles of terrain. So the new plan went the other direction entirely. Every aircraft would come in low, not medium low, not low for a heavy bomber. Rooftop low, 200 to 300 feet. Low enough to see faces in the windows of the refineries. Low enough that the delay fuses on the bombs were a genuine concern, because the blast radius of 500-pound bombs dropped at that altitude could reach the releasing aircraft before they cleared the target. Low enough that the kill zone for flak guns was measured in feet and not miles. They had built detailed scale models of each refinery complex at their base in Libya. The crews flew practice runs over the desert, learning the silhouettes of their targets, memorizing the approach headings, rehearsing the timing. Five bomb groups were assigned to Tidal Wave. The 44th Bombardment Group, known as the Eight Balls. The 93rd, Ted's Traveling Circus. The 98th, the Pyramiders. The 376th, the Liberandos. And the 389th, the Sky Scorpions. Together, they were some of the most experienced heavy bombardment units the Army Air Forces had in the theater. The mission launched in the pre-dawn darkness of August 1st. 17 aircraft aborted before the formation even crossed the Mediterranean. One went into the sea shortly after takeoff. So the number that actually pressed into the Balkans was somewhere around 164, already short of what the planners had put on paper. Then, over the Wallachian Plain, something went wrong. At a key navigation checkpoint, a rail junction the lead navigators were using as their initial turn point, there was confusion in the lead element. The lead group, the 376th, made a turn. They were following a recognizable landmark, but it was the wrong one. They turned at the wrong town. Some of the trailing groups recognized immediately that something was off. They held their course and tried to reroute. Others followed the lead, assuming the lead group knew something they didn't. By the time anyone sorted it out, the formation was fractured. Groups that had been in trail were now ahead of their assigned targets. Groups were pointed at refineries they hadn't briefed. The carefully constructed attack plan, where each group hit a specific cluster of refineries in a coordinated wave, was unraveling in real time over Romania. And the Germans knew they were coming. Romanian radar had picked up the formation hours before. The flak batteries were manned. The fighter squadrons were airborne. Steel cables tethered to barrage balloons were strung across the approach corridors. Gunners had been positioned in haystacks on church steeples, behind any structure that could conceal a weapon along the route, from the mountains to the plains. It was a prepared defense, and the formation was flying into it at 200 feet, with no room to maneuver and no altitude to trade for anything. Here's what 200 feet over a defended target actually means. At altitude, flak bursts near the formation and the crew counts the holes afterward. At 200 feet, if the shell goes off, it's right there. Rifles work at that altitude. Machine gun fire from the ground is direct and flat, not arcing up from below. Balloon cables can take a wing off. And when the aircraft ahead of you releases its bombs and the fireball climbs, you are flying through the fireball. There is no going over it. There is no going around it. You fly through it, or you don't reach the target. The crews flew through it. Colonel Addison Baker was leading the 93rd Bomb Group that day. His aircraft was a B-24 named Hell's Wench. When Baker's formation reached the White Ivy refinery complex, his airplane was already on fire. The crew had options. They could divert, they could release early and pull away. They could do what any rational calculation of survival would suggest. Baker held the formation together. He pressed through the target. He led the 93rd over the White 5 complex at low level with fire on board. His aircraft was still burning when it cleared the last refinery building. It came down in a field a few miles beyond the complex. There were no survivors. Colonel Baker received the Medal of Honor posthumously. His co-pilot that day was Major John Gierstad. Now here's something that needs to be said about Gierstad. He had completed his combat tour. He was done. He was rotating home. He volunteered for the Plessy mission because he wanted to be there. He had no orders putting him in that cockpit. He chose it. When Hell's Wench went in, Gierstad went with Baker and the rest of the crew. Major Gierstad received the Medal of Honor posthumously. Two medals of honor, one airplane, one crew. Colonel John Riley Kane led the 98th Bomb Group. Everyone called him Killer Kane, and not in a way that was unflattering. Kane was a combat commander in the old mold. His group had been assigned the Columbia Aquila refinery complex. When the formation fragmented on the approach, Kane found his group converging on a target already under attack. Smoke rising through thousands of feet, secondary explosions cooking off in the storage tanks as the bombs from the first wave found fuel. Kane led the 98th in anyway. There are mission reports describing Kane's aircraft emerging from the target area with bomb bay doors bent back from a near explosion, an engine trailing smoke, and pieces of refinery structure embedded in the fuselage. His aircraft was flying on whatever structural integrity the Consolidated Vultee engineers had built into the design and the grace of whatever gods look after heavy bomber crews. Kane brought what was left of his group home to Benghazi. He received the Medal of Honor. He survived the war. Colonel Leon Johnson led the 44th, the 8 Balls. His group's approach was also compromised by the navigational error, and Johnson arrived at his target to find confusion, smoke, and a defense that had been fully alerted. He pressed the attack. His aircraft took hits. He held formation. He led the 8 Balls through. Johnson received the Medal of Honor. He survived the war. The 5th Medal of Honor that day went to 2nd Lieutenant Lloyd Hughes. He was 22 years old. Hughes was flying with the 389th, assigned to the Campina refinery, the most distant target in the complex, requiring the deepest penetration of the defended corridor. Before Hughes even reached the initial point of the attack, his aircraft took a hit to the fuel system. Gasoline was streaming from the wings. The crew behind him in formation could see it. Anyone in that cockpit could feel it. The aircraft was a match waiting to be struck, and they were about to fly through fire. Hughes did not pull out of the attack. He took his Liberator through the target, released his bombs, and was clearing the Campina complex when the fuel ignited. The aircraft came down a few miles beyond the refinery. Hughes was 22 years old. He received the Medal of Honor posthumously. 5 medals of honor. One mission, one afternoon, in Romania. No single military operation in the history of the United States Armed Forces has produced 5 medals of honor in a single action. That record has stood since August 1, 1943, and it has never been approached. The cost of tidal wave was enormous. 54 aircraft lost out of the 164 that reached Romania. That's roughly 1 in 3. 310 men killed, 108 taken prisoner by the Germans and Romanians. 78 others interned in neutral Turkey after their damaged aircraft couldn't make it back to Libya and they diverted rather than go down in hostile territory. Nearly 500 crewmen were casualties in one afternoon. And then comes the hard part of the story. The damage to the refineries was real. The Concordia Vega complex was essentially destroyed. Several other targets were badly damaged, but the Germans and Romanians had substantial repair capacity, and within weeks, production at Ploiești was recovering. Within months, it was largely restored. The strategic objective, to permanently cripple Axis fuel production, was not achieved by tidal wave alone. Ploesti was attacked again. And again after that, high-altitude missions through the rest of 43, dozens of missions in 44. It was not until August of 1944, when Romanian forces switched sides and Allied ground troops approached the region, that the Ploesti refineries finally went offline permanently. So you can argue the tactics, you can argue about whether the navigational error was preventable, whether the element of surprise could have been preserved differently, whether the low-level approach was the right call to begin with. Historians have had those arguments for 80 years and they'll keep having them. But there is something in that Sunday that sits outside the tactical calculus. Baker and Gerstad didn't have to be in that airplane. Baker could have broken off when the fire started. Hughes had every justification a reasonable man could want to abort the attack run. Kane and Johnson flew through chaos and smoke and held their formations together out of will more than anything the airplane could offer them. 200 feet over a burning oil refinery with flak going through both wings and the instruments still reading, and the airplane still responding. That's not training, that's not procedure. That's something in the character of the men who chose to sit in those seats. Pull up a chair sometime and think about that. Much of what I've shared today comes from the Air Force Historical Research Agency records, the 15th Air Force Mission Archives, and historian James Dugan and Carol Stewart's account, simply called Ploesti, which remains the definitive treatment of the mission. If you want to go deeper, that book is where to start. Find us at RadioHangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. We'll be back in the hangar soon.